The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. And as usual, we've got a lot to fit in, a lot of news to talk about. We're going to give you a bit of a sneak preview of the upcoming Key of David show that's going to air this weekend, because it really does explain a whole, just a big factor behind what's going on in the news that you're seeing from Europe. We will talk about that in a little bit. But first, I need to talk about some news from the UK. It's been a pretty dramatic day yesterday for British political news. A record-breaking day, a historic day even, in terms of some of the things that have been going on inside Britain's Parliament. Britain's Attorney General, Geoffrey Cox, he was found in contempt of Parliament in a vote yesterday. This is the first time that this has ever happened to a government minister. And, you know, with the parliamentary history that goes back so long, it's very rare to have those first times. You know, it's more, oh, this is the first time since 1579. But nope, the first time ever that a government minister has been found in contempt of Parliament. The government also lost three votes in one day. It was in just over an hour and a half time period. It's the first time a government's done that and had such a defeat in the House of Commons in 40 years. And all this is going on with the backdrop on the countdown to the crucial vote on the Brexit deal on Tuesday. So what is going on in Britain? Well, the latest, you know, this all revolves around Brexit. So on Theresa May's negotiated this withdrawal agreement, which nobody likes. Those that want to stay in the EU don't like it because they'd rather stay in the EU. Those that leave the EU don't like it because it basically commits Britain to being stuck keeping all of the EU's rules and having no say. And it holds Northern Ireland hostage. So nobody really likes it. And there's going to be the Parliament is going to vote on that on Tuesday. Now, the government has been refusing to publish the legal advice they received about this text. And everyone, well, I think a lot of people have been quite curious why they've been refusing, but they've been refusing. Parliament held a vote and told them they had to publish it. The government said no. And so there was this second vote yesterday where Parliament found the government in contempt of Parliament. So it's a very humiliating position for a government to be in. It also shows the government's weakness. You know, if Theresa May and her government can't prevent themselves from being found in contempt of Parliament and having this rebuke, well, how are they going to be able to get Brexit through Parliament? That if they can't, you'd have thought they would have pulled out all the stops to prevent themselves being found in contempt. Didn't work. When they do the same coming up, are they going to make it through? Well, the Telegraph, they wrote, Theresa May suffered humiliation on a historic scale on Tuesday as her government became the first to be found in contempt of Parliament. Mrs. May lost three Brexit-related votes in the space of barely an hour, making her the first Prime Minister in 40 years to be defeated three times in one day. And so that gives you a sense of the political chaos in Britain right now. The Spectator, they wrote, one cabinet minister is privately predicting that we're heading for the gravest constitutional crisis in our history. This is hyperbole. They wrote the 17th century had several that were far worse. And I think they're right on that. But the next few weeks will put greater strain on the Constitution than any other event in the past 100 years. So, really an epic level of chaos and division at the same time that you've got this really important and historic vote going through the Parliament. Another Spectator piece pointed out the chances of an early election has risen significantly. So you've got the government losing its authority, you've got the prospect of the government falling, of a general election, all revolving around Brexit. And that's not even the only thing that happened yesterday. Nigel Farage. He came on his radio show yesterday, and he made a big announcement. And we've chopped a few, or tried to get the best bits of the start of his show as he came and gave this dramatic announcement.
I joined UKIP, well, my card here says in 1992, because that was when it was the Anti-Federalist League. So for over a quarter of a century, I've been involved in UKIP and its forerunner. I have worked tirelessly for UKIP. I've spoken at 1,500 public meetings up and down the country during those years. I've travelled hundreds of thousands of miles, and the aim was very simple. It was to take votes away from the establishment parties to force a vote in this country that would get us back our independence. And you could argue that in 2016 we had been pretty successful. One of the keys to that was talking about things that everybody else wanted to brush under the carpet. Issues like immigration, which we were told, if you discuss that, it's somehow disreputable. I made sure that UKIP talked about tough issues, but we absolutely excluded anybody who'd ever been a member of the British National Party, the English Defence League. We wanted to make sure that when the abuse was thrown at us, it couldn't possibly be proved to be true. Now, I'm afraid that over the course of the last few months, under this leader, Mr. Gerard Batten, a lot has changed. And he seems to be pretty obsessed with the issue of Islam, not just Islamic extremism, but Islam. And UKIP wasn't founded to be a party based on fighting a religious crusade. And also obsessed with this figure called Tommy Robinson, whose real name is Stephen Yaxley Lennon, who is seen by some to be a great hero, standing up and fighting for working class people, but who has a pretty suspect record, and who brings with him a group of people, I'm afraid, amongst which we see scuffles, violence, many have criminal records, some pretty serious. And all of it's been dragging UKIP away from being an electoral party into a party of street activism. I have warned, and I wrote 10 days ago, that this direction was catastrophic, particularly at a time when the great Brexit betrayal is upon us. Both the Labour and Conservative parties have broken promises that were made, not just in the referendum, but in the general election as well. Things couldn't be better for UKIP, but unfortunately, we've gone in this direction of street activism and turning a blind eye to extremist politics. Many of the best people that I've worked with over those many long years have already left the party in the space of the last few weeks. There was one last hope that the party's national executive at the weekend would do something about this, would, pass a motion of no confidence in Gerard Batten. Damaging UKIP is one thing. Damaging the Brexit cause is even worse. And I, with a very heavy heart, given how much I've cared for this party, the people within it, have reached, I think, a very sad decision, certainly very sad for me, that I simply can't go on with it. I don't recognise the party as being the one that I helped to found and fought for all of those years. I believe the brand has been now so damaged, so tarnished, that it's not able to pick up and won't be able to pick up the political opportunity that's there, staring it in the face. And so with very great reluctance, I have, as of now, resigned my membership of UKIP, cancelled by standing order at the bank. I'm no longer a member of UKIP, which, hey, it's made up the biggest part of my adult life. It's a very sad thing to do. But there it is. It's done.
So Nigel Farage has left UKIP. And you heard his reasons there, his objection to Tommy Robinson and some of the individuals around him who have various different criminal records for assault being kind of brought into the heart of the party, and his accusations about being becoming a street movement rather than a political movement. All right, at this stage, I'm not too sure even what to make of that, but he's left UKIP. UKIP's been in some chaos, some turmoil for some time now, and so you just look just about everywhere you look now in British politics, there's division, there's disorder. I mean, you look at the government. The government is split. There have been all these people leaving the cabinet. There's so many people within the Conservative Party opposing what Theresa May is doing. Theresa May is really even betraying the Brexit vote and going against what she said that she wanted to do. She's going against the red lines that said she would never agree with. She used to say that a bad deal is better than no deal, and now she's flipped. And I mean, sorry, she used to say that a bad deal was worse than no deal. Now she's flipped on that and saying, well, we need to go with this deal because a no deal is the opposite. You've got all this chaos and turmoil in the Conservative Party. Meanwhile, in the Labour Party, you've got Jeremy Corbyn and the Radical Socialists in charge, and they're still a lot of people have compromised within that party with the Radicals, but there's still a lot of division there, and you've got just that party in a pretty unprecedented situation with some of these people that really hate the United Kingdom leading that party. And then now even UKIP, where Nigel Farage, by far the biggest, most influential person in that party, who has just really led that party to great prominence and great success, now leaving because he disagrees with the direction it's going, and there's no denying there's a lot of now division, disorganization within UKIP. I mean, where do you look in British politics if you want hope for the future? Where is there where there looks like there's any strength? Any consistency? Any ability to turn things around? I mean, even the two leaders, Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May, they've both said they want to do a debate about the Brexit agreements on Sunday, and that all seems like it's falling apart because neither of them can agree on the time. Something as simple as a debate on Brexit we can't seem to organise. You see the government being held in contempt of Parliament for the first time ever. I mean, and then this is just days away from that vote, just coming up on Tuesday, on the Brexit withdrawal agreement. There's been all of this chaos, and it's all revolved around the European Union and getting Britain out of the European Union. It reminds me of an article Mr. MacDonald wrote right at the start of the Brexit process. Unfortunately, I didn't note down the name, but he writes in that, "Let's leave the European Union and make Britain great again." That, in essence, was the Leave campaign's mantra leading up to June 2015, when there was this Brexit vote. "We must take back control of this great country's destiny." That's what Boris Johnson said, and he quoted in that article. Nigel Farage says, "We must dare to dream that dawn is breaking out on an independent United Kingdom." Is that what we see now, where we're coming up to the withdrawal agreement passing? Is dawn breaking out on an independent United Kingdom? Well, now you've got Nigel Farage quitting UKIP. There we go. The article, Sam's just pulled it up for me, is "Brexit Exposes UK's Many Infirmities." Brexit exposes UK's many infirmities. And that's exactly what we're seeing now, more clearly than ever, as we head to that crucial Brexit vote. Mr. MacDonald wrote, "The Leave campaign sold an upbeat, hope-filled message, one that obviously resonated with many Brits. But so far, there's been no bright, sunlit uplands. The Leave campaign's message has a fatal flaw, and one that grows more obvious with every sunset. The message assumed Britain had the capacity to survive a messy, possibly vindictive divorce and restore itself as a strong, stable, sovereign world power. Messrs. Johnson and Farage and their supporters believe Britain has the health to survive a Brexit. But what if they're wrong? What if Britain is too sick to survive the challenges ahead? And what have we seen now? Just this Britain that's divided and sick and unable to cope with even the challenges of leaving Brexit. I mean, that doesn't mean that we're anti-Brexit at all. We've talked for a long, long time, well before the referendum, about what a curse the European Union has been for Britain. What a mistake it was for Britain to join the European Union. I personally was very, very happy when the announcements of that referendum came out. But, you know, joining the European Union was a crutch. We didn't want to stand on our own two feet. Leaders didn't really have the vision to chart their own destiny for the United Kingdom, so they joined UKIP. I mean, so they joined the European Union. And, well, that was easier. Just letting somebody else plot your course for you and just say yes, sir, and follow along. Let somebody else pass your laws, someone else determine your role in the world. It's not glorious, but it's easier. And now we needed now it came to leaving the European Union, something that requires some strength in negotiations, some vision about what you want the country to be, just some robust health to survive on our own. And we've been unable to muster that, and it's led to just great chaos and disillusionment. And in that article, Mr. MacDonald brought out how this was prophesied. He quotes Hosea 5, verse 11 and 12, where it says, "Ephraim is oppressed and broken in judgment because he willingly walked after the commandment. Therefore will I be unto Ephraim as a moth." And what we know, and we talk about on this show a lot, Ephraim in Bible prophecy refers to England, refers to Britain. And you can read much more about that in our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. That will really get to the heart and get to the cause of why Britain isn't prospering post-Brexit. That book is a great place to go to get the full understanding of what's going on here. But Mr. MacDonald, in that article, he builds off that metaphor that God is using here. I will be to Ephraim as a moth. And I mean, I know you could probably tell if you've watched any of my This Week in Germany videos. I'm not a person who gets particularly excited about clothes, but maybe there are people that do. I don't really care much about what I'm wearing, but maybe you're very excited to put on a particular garment, just as there was a lot of excitement about leaving the European Union. It looks good. You can imagine how good you'll look wearing it. Take it out of the cupboard. But once it's out of the cupboard, well, then it's clear. Actually, it may have looked good, but it's all moth-eaten. You put it on and it just falls apart. And Mr. MacDonald writes, "That is Britain's current state, and Brexit is revealing that the UK is ridden with holes. Looks good on the surface, but something that requires some real substance, some real strength, causes everything all to fall apart." And we're seeing that every day before our eyes in Britain, and especially yesterday, with everything going on, there's record-breaking developments, there's record-breaking votes in the House of Commons. And Mr. MacDonald goes through other passages, like Hosea 7, verses 8 and 9, that says that Ephraim, he has mixed himself among the people, strangers have devoured his strength, and he knows it not. So strangers, people from foreign powers, foreign countries have devoured Britain's strength. But it doesn't realize it. The Date Nation doesn't realize this. Just like so many prophesying that Brexit would lead us into the bright sunlit uplands. Well, they didn't realize, well, actually your strength has been devoured. He also references Isaiah 1, verses 5 to 7, that talks about the whole head is sick, the whole heart is faint. And that's what we see at every level. The nation is becoming dysfunctioning. Mr. MacDonald wrote, "That's a hard truth to accept and deliver, but what an apt description. We would all love to believe that Britain is entering bright sunlit uplands. But the truth of the matter is that Britain is plummeting down into the dark abyss of total political, economic, and social breakdown." That's what he wrote back in 2015. And look at what we see now. Now, I don't want to discount the possibility of some kind of resurgence. Maybe Britain will pull off something in terms of this Brexit negotiations. Maybe the withdrawal deal won't happen and Britain will be able to leave the EU more fully and prosper because of it for a short time. But where is there any long-term health and strength in any of these institutions, political leaders, political parties that we see in such a mess right now? And this is exactly what the Bible said would happen. You know, those descriptions, the moth-eaten garment, it's just a perfect description of Britain right now, and one we're just seeing revealed in our news every day. And I mentioned that free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. You can get a copy of that, and that will help show you just how the Bible said that this would come about, why God is allowing this to happen to Britain, that God has a purpose for Britain, a plan for Britain. And at the moment, he's punishing Britain. That's part of that plan. But there's a lesson for Britain to learn, and there's a way to receive blessings again, both individually and for the nation. So you can read that book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Well, we'll take a quick break, and when we'll get back, we'll get into our next subject, and that sneak preview of the upcoming Key of David show.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
President Macron has made some pretty shocking statements to the world in the last few weeks, and he just last week made another stunning statement before the world when he was in Berlin addressing the Germans. And he made the statement in his speech, if you do not understand the words from France, remember that France loves Germany. France loves Germany. Now, what kind of a statement is that? He never has said anything like that to his two brothers, and they are sons of Israel. And there are other ones, but there's a lot of focus on especially Joseph in this end time. So here he's saying that he loves, that France loves Germany. And France was taken out of captivity to Germany in World War I and World War II by Britain and America. And he's just turning his back on them, as he was prophesied to do. Now, he loves Germany. And he says France loves Germany. And he is speaking for them, I think, in many respects. But I think that's a most pathetic statement. And I think it's almost like saying, well, they just don't have the will to ever stand up against Germany again. So they're just going to join in with them. And France will betray his brother Joseph, which is Britain and America.
So that was that sneak preview. We'll have another clip from that as well, from this upcoming Key of David show. It's a really powerful Key of David, continuing in the same series that we've heard over the last couple of weeks, just really showing how the European Union is ready to explode on the world scene, how so much of that is there that they just need this confidence-inspiring leader, but also just how France is helping that happen, is supporting Germany in developing that European Union. And that's something that really comes across from some of the news this week as well. I want to show you how that Key of David ties in very well with that. Now, I think you're probably familiar with the riots in France. Mr. Fleury spoke about those on an earlier show. If you're not familiar, they've sounded something like this. So really quite dramatic, widespread chaos going on over there. Cars burning, some kind of explosion going off there. There's a lot of police been injured, violence in some of these major iconic French locations like the Arc de Triomphe. So just pretty chaotic situation. The Spectator described it well. They had an article, but this is about it, on the Avenue Kléber, one of the toniest streets in Paris. I have no idea what toniest means. I should have looked that up. And the heart of the district where Macron would have been expecting to resettle his beloved bankers fleeing London, like Sans Couleur. Every bank has been attacked, every shop window broken, upscale apartments have been attacked, and every Porsche and Mercedes within blocks set on fire. So there's massive chaos in France. And Mr. Fleury talked about that earlier in the week. And the immediate cause of these protests, like he talked about, is these fuel hikes. Putting up these big taxes on petrol and diesel. I like that the way that Spectator article put it. They said that Macron's hubris, arrogance, and almost autistic detachment from the French in the streets is in a class with Marie Antoinette. Except this time around, the courtier whispers, "Mr. President, the people cannot afford diesel," to which the cloth-eared Macron has, in effect, replied, "Let them buy Teslas." And so Mr. Flory talked about these taxes and these riots in connection with the Paris Climate Change Accords. But there is also more to these riots than just the fuel tax. That's certainly the biggest part of it, and definitely the thing that's really, really set them off. But they also stem from this whole background of anger at Emmanuel Macron, and that anger goes right back to Macron's policy with Germany. Now, these tax hikes, Macron's announced that he's going to freeze them, but the protests go on. One protester, they told the Times, "The freeze on fuel tax is not enough." Yeah, I could do it in a bad French accent. I can have some fun. "What we want is for Macron and his government to resign." I'm sure they said it something like that. So they're talking about a revolution, or a revolution, seeing as this is France. They want to get rid of the president, and he's made himself very unpopular. What has he done to make himself unpopular like that? Well, Politico talked about some of these reforms that have been going on that have made Macron unpopular, and they wrote, "It was clear from the outset that for Macron to realize his European agenda, he would first have to show that he could reform France. For years, Berlin watched with growing frustration, bordering on panic, as both Nicolas Sarkozy and François Hollande failed to enact serious reforms in the face of the country's increasingly difficult economic situation. Macron knew that to succeed in Europe, he would have to win over Germany. And the only way to do that is to fix France." So Germany wants France to make these economic reforms. And Macron, as part of his policy that we heard about even from Mr. Fleury, of playing second fiddle for Germany, of saying, "Well, you know, we don't have the will to resist Germany. We're going to support you and we'll gain power kind of as your number two. We don't have the will on our own to stand on our own. We're going to throw in our lot with Germany." So as part of doing that, they've been making all of these reforms to France. And that has played a large part and gone a large way to making him very unpopular. German Foreign Policy wrote about this last week as well. They wrote, "The federal government of Germany bears joint responsibility for the current crisis in France. This is the result of studies by the German Council on Foreign Relations. Accordingly, President Emmanuel Macron has made his reforms, which have repeatedly provided for violent, now escalating protests, according to German demands, in the hope that Berlin will meet him in European politics and allow him serious reforms." They continue, "The fact that the reform measures which France President Emmanuel Macron has begun to implement immediately after assuming office on the 14th of May 2017, and which he continues to this day, are largely in line with German demands. And this was confirmed in the spring by the German Council on Foreign Relations, which they point out in a concise analysis." So the protests in France are directly connected to Macron throwing in his lot with Germany. So what exactly is going on here? Well, as we've talked about many times on this show, on the Trumpet Hour, the Eurozone, as it is, doesn't work. It's an engine of crisis. It keeps generating more crises. It locks all of these very different countries together with a single currency. And having separate governments share a currency, it's a bit like having separate households share a credit card, or separate people share a mortgage. The spending decisions, the income of other people is going to directly affect you and your prosperity. If some of the other people stop paying that shared mortgage, you're going to suffer. If they put up a lot of bills on that shared credit card, you're going to suffer. Now, it's not quite as direct as sharing a credit card, but that's a reasonable way of looking at it. It works in the United States. All of the different states can share a currency, can share the dollar, because they're willing to accept the common fate that goes with that. You know, they're willing to have it so that some states take in more than they get out of the federal government in terms of revenue. Other states will pay in much less and take out much more. and nobody really has a massive problem with that. That's the way it just has to work for a common currency area to function without constantly generating these different economic crises where one place just keeps running out of cash. Now, this is the state of affairs. Well, it's a bit of a worry for Germany because, you know, they share a credit card, say, with all of these other countries. If other countries lay up big bills, they end up getting hit with some of the penalty for that. And they've paid the bills for other countries because they've worried that leaving them unpaid would hurt them more. Now, this shared credit card, the shared currency, has actually had some major advantages to Germany as well by weakening the euro, but that's in a way that's much less obvious to German voters. And so many want Europe to move towards being more of a superstate just to stop these financial crises. So you're sharing more money around the eurozone and you're able to stabilize some of these crises. But Germany is worried that, well, if we all shared our tax and spending money more, we're just going to get ripped off. Because you've got a lot of other countries in the eurozone, they have much more inefficient economies and much more generous welfare systems. And so Germany doesn't want to end up paying for a bunch of other countries to get a lot of welfare that Germans can't have at home. That's a recipe for vote losing. So, yeah, Germany wants a European superstate, but they want to have it in such a way that Germany doesn't end up paying for other people in Southern Europe to have early retirement or massive generous welfare benefits. So they want rules in place to stop that. Rules in place to force everybody to make their economy and their governments, their spending plans look much more like Germany's. And so that's basically the deal Macron has popped up with. You know, Germany, we will make the reforms you want in France. We'll help you get other countries to make them. And in exchange, we want this common tax, common spending, the step towards a super state. You know, we'll help you have that super state. And we'll help other nations make those changes. And then when that's there, well, hopefully we can have some of your cash in case we're to help stabilize the eurozone and prevent these crises. And so that's what Macron's been going about doing, reforming the economy, the French economy, in line of with what Germany wants, pushing this combined French and German plan for a common European treasury with common European taxes and spending. He has been awarded the Charlemagne Prize because of this policy. You know, it's an economic policy that's all about exactly what Mr. Fleury talked about in this upcoming Key of David. You know, we're going to throw in our lot with you, Germany, and we're going to do it even financially. We'll make our economy look the way that you want it to look. We'll turn ourselves into the ideal economic partner for you. We'll join with you. Now, these reforms may well be good for France in the long run. France has some pretty ridiculous laws in place, and especially in its labor market. For example, it's been, historically at least, almost impossible to fire someone in France, and certainly to make someone redundant. You know, if you hire someone in France, you just kind of have to know you're hiring them for life, and it's going to be really hard for you to get rid of them. Some companies have just been reduced to doing things like giving someone a really pointless, meaningless job, making sure that they know it's pointless and meaningless, putting them somewhere where everybody can see them doing this pointless and meaningless job to make sure that they keep doing it and they can't do things that they enjoy on the job time, and just waiting for them to get so demoralized that they quit of their own free will. As if you want to get rid of someone, that's one of the few ways to do it. And so by changing some of these things, well, that may help France. But it's been proven unpopular with a lot of people in France, especially on the left, because just on the surface, this idea of, well, you can't fire people, you can't make people redundant, sounds great. Jobs for everyone. In reality, it actually makes jobs scarcer because companies, big businesses, don't want to move to France because they know, well, if we hire a bunch of people and it doesn't work out, it's going to be really hard to get rid of them. But he's doing this, the big motivation for Macron for doing this, even if it benefits France, is to throw his lot in with Germany. He's letting Germany tell him what to do in the French economy. And there are talks going on right now about building this European treasury that he wants, and that would really cement Germany's rules over the superstate. There was a meeting that finished up yesterday morning where they were discussing this. They didn't manage to make any final conclusions on this. They pushed that back to a higher level meeting next week to try and come up with some kind of final deal. You know, Italy, for example, does not want to sign up to stick to these rules, so they're fighting it. But you've got this, you know, this Franco-German initiative, and they're trying to convince Europe to deal with these German rules. They've really thrown in their lot with Germany just on the European financial level as well. They're trying to do this in exchange to get some of Germany's cash. So they're moving forward on this, and France is really helping to build this European Union. And that's one of the things that Mr. Fleury talked about in that show. You know, France has abandoned Britain and America. They've thrown their lot in with Germany. They're building up Germany. And we see that, like I said, on the financial level as well. Well, we'll take a quick break. When we get back, we'll have another sneak preview clip from that Key of David and look at another aspect of this that Mr. Fleury looked at on that show.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The Holy Roman Empire has made pivotal and defining contributions to Western civilization, but its many reincarnations have also come with painful and catastrophic consequences. European leaders aim to unite the fractured continent of Europe by reviving the legacy of this extraordinary church-state combine. One of the great lessons of this empire is that it always comes back. There is always another resurrection. To understand much more on this vital subject, call now and request our free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. The Holy Roman Empire is not just a relic of history. It is about to play a central role in world events. Coming to understand about the nature and character of this powerful institution tells you as much about the future as it does about the past. As part of this free offer, also request Herbert Armstrong's classic work, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast? Both booklets are available at no cost or obligation to you. In addition to the free book, you may also request a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. The Trumpet examines world events under the clear light of Bible prophecy. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
There is going to be a resurrection of that old Roman Empire. Not very many people believe it, because people have gotten completely beyond really believing that the Bible means what it says. You're going to have to live and see it, and you're going to have to know that God was speaking when he said this thing is coming.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
I want to focus more today, and I did not get into this too much last week, but I wanted to focus on this true European army. What is he talking about? Is it something they're just thinking about, or is it something almost, well, we could say already looking like a superpower? There's a lot going on in Europe with their military that most people know very little, if anything, about. Germany has quite a history, as you know, because they started World War I and World War II. But here is Macron saying now that really, indirectly, and he's implying that Europe doesn't need NATO anymore. So we don't want NATO. We need a true European army. It's not enough that they've been protected by America and Britain in many ways.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. That was another sneak preview from the upcoming Key of David show. Mr. Fleury there talking about this European army and the progress they've already made towards this European army, the efforts Europeans are already making. And you look at the statements Macron's made earlier, and you can see how they're already against the United States, how they want this European army to work against the United States. And he went through in that program some of the steps that they've taken. And there are some major steps Europe's taken towards a European army. I've said, as I've said before, in many ways there is already a European army. It's called the German army. Two-thirds of the Dutch army, they're part of the German army. A good chunk of the Czech and the Romanian armies, part of the German army. Mr. Flurry went on to talk about some of the weapons developments that's going on in Europe. You know, they're saying, well, we don't like the US. We want our own weapons. We're going to make our own weapon systems so we can be independent from the US. We don't want to use theirs anymore. Now, despite this open hostility to the US, America is still helping Europe massively. I talked about this in my trumpet brief yesterday, with America selling various different European nations the F-35, Joint Strike Fighter, one of the most advanced fighter jets ever. Italy, the Netherlands, Denmark, Norway, and Belgium. They're just some of the European countries in the process of buying F-35s. Germany's thinking about getting them, but they're also, you know, they'd much rather have a European alternative. But they're buying these F-35s. Now, I've been critical in the past and on this show of the F-35, and I still think it is a bad deal. US weapons companies, they're continually designing weapons not to be as functional as possible, to be the best weapons possible, but to create as many jobs in key congressional districts as possible. Because if they don't do that, Congress gets kind of halfway through the funding and then decides to pull the plug and cancel the weapons program, and they end up being tons of money in the red. Or is it in the black? I can't remember now. But anyway, they lose a lot of money. So now, rather than trying to design an effective weapon system, they tend to design... Think about, they get a map out. Well, who do we need? Who's supporting Congress? Do we need to make sure we ensure? Who are going to be the swing voters? Well, let's make sure... Then, okay, now let's get a list out of companies that make stuff in their states, the big employers in their states. Let's make sure we place a contract with them. Okay, what can we put in our design on our plane that will require us to place a contract with that company? It's a horrible way to design a fighter jet, and I think it explains many of the F-35 shortcomings, if that indeed is how it was designed. And I think there's the Program for Government Oversight that did a report. Anyway, I wrote on that some years ago. Oh, I think the article's called Not Much Bang for Your Buck, on just how these weapon systems are manipulated, and it's all done to create jobs. And so I think, you know, the end result is these bloated, overly complicated, because you're trying to get all of these different jobs, and overly expensive designs. And the F-35 certainly appears to be a classic example of that. You know, its complexity might be its biggest weakness. It's so vulnerable for hacking that in 2006 they were going to do a cyber warfare test to test its spare parts and logistics software, and they cancelled the test because they were worried that they would accidentally shut down every single F-35 in operation. Just testing it. How's that going to perform in actual combat? That's a pretty major vulnerability. But handing these planes over, selling them to Europe and also to Japan and other allies in the Middle East, I think Saudi Arabia might be getting some, that's still a major level of transfer of technology for the United States. They're handing over some serious capabilities that they'd never given before to these other powers. You know, America hasn't shared stealth aircraft before. Things like the B-2 bomber, the F-117 Nighthawk, the F-22 Raptor, these other stealth planes. You know, those were all American planes. American-only planes. Not even, say, Britain or Israel or Australia had those in their air force. And now, though, they're giving these countries the F-35. And the F-35, it's not just stealth. Unlike those other planes, the F-35 can be carried on aircraft carriers. So they can be taken around the world and then carry out a stealth attack just about anywhere in the world. And the F-35s are capable of carrying nuclear bombs. In fact, America is paying to upgrade the nuclear bombs it has given to Europe so they can fit on the F-35. So America is gifting Europe with the ability to carry out stealthy nuclear strikes anywhere they can reach from an aircraft carrier. This is also, it's meant to be the main fighter jet for the US Navy and Marines, you know, going all the way up until 2070. So they're handing over, you know, this is the plane that America is going to rely on. They're selling it to these other powers for them to look at, to study, to understand. They'll have a detailed knowledge of all of the vulnerabilities and weaknesses and strengths of these aircraft. So that's a huge level of trust. In that Key of David that was coming up on the weekend, Mr. Flurry talked about Europe's plans now to build their own fighter jet. Here's what he said about that.
We say to our defense ministers, our political leaders, we are ready. If the cooperation succeeds, the future jet, this is a jet fighter, is predicted to outperform the U.S.'s F-35 fighter jet. What do you think about that? What power they already have? They have this powerful military and this powerful empire economically, and all they need now is a strong man to come on the scene and replace Angela Merkel, as we show in our trumpet, the beginning of the end. She's about to go, and probably that strong man is going to come on the scene, and he has this empire there, and their new Charlemagne is coming on the scene, and it's going to change the course of this world. We have been prophesying that for over 70 years.
So it's almost all set, basically, for this strong man to come on the scene. They're working out, they're putting together plans for these really advanced fighter jets already. They don't have a strong leader yet, but he's going to come along and they'll have a lot of these plans already in place. But they're selling these... America's selling these F-35 planes to Italy, to the Netherlands, to Belgium, nations that are almost certainly going to be involved when Europe starts making their own fighter jet. And they'll have America's designs then. They'll have the actual planes. America's stealthy plane. Europe's never built a stealth plane before. At least not kind of to a full production level. And they'll have these planes that they can copy from. Italy, for example. Italy's Leonardo. They have a 20% share at stake in the Eurofighter Consortium when Europe got together to build a fighter jet before. So they'll probably, very probably, be involved. Are they going to be passing on? These are all the ways that America's jet works. Okay, it may have these weaknesses, but it's stealth. It's got all this groundbreaking technology. This is how we can reverse engineer it. Let's have a look at it. But they're pushing on with these plans. Handelsblatt talked about these plans to build a new plane, and they wrote on the November 6th, Germany and France plan to develop the most advanced air defense system in the world. The joint armament is a declaration of war against the United States because they have already sold several European countries the modern F-35. So they're saying, we're going in direct competition with you, but we'll accept deliveries of your plane for us to take ideas from. And America's fine with that. Handelsblatt, they also wrote, perhaps nothing represents the Franco-German ambition to free Europe from dependence on the United States more than the joint system to develop a new fighter jet as part of a comprehensive air combat system. So they're giving America that fight, Europe this fighter jet, or selling it to them. And as I said, that's not it. The US is paying to upgrade Europe's nuclear bombs. So America has given nuclear bombs to the Netherlands, to Italy, to Germany, to Turkey. Given them nuclear bombs to go on European planes, so the German bombs can go on German planes in time of crisis and be used by Germans. Handed over these nuclear bombs essentially for Germany to use. And they're going to upgrade them so that they can fit on these stealthy planes. America's, at least they're getting some money from selling these F-35s, but they're giving these nuclear bombs, basically, and then paying to have them upgraded. Mr. Flurry's drawn attention to this on several occasions. Here's a 2009 Key of David program, Europe's Dirty Nuclear Bomb Secret.
Now, you don't hear very much about that, but do you know that the U.S. has nuclear bombs in Germany, for example, who started both world wars and even started a war in 1870 that took control of half of France? So they have a history of doing that. Also, we have nuclear bombs in Italy, and they were our enemy in World War II. So is it wise for us to be doing this, having our nuclear arms there? And there's a lot more to it than just that, that is, I think, very mind-chilling. Let me explain to you what I mean by first commenting and quoting this article from Time magazine. What to do about Europe's secret nukes? Secret nukes, Time wrote on December 2, 2009, quote, 20 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, Dutch, Belgian, Italian, and German pilots remain ready to engage in nuclear war. Now, these are German pilots are ready to take our bombs and engage in nuclear war. And this is 20 years after the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall, when you'd think, well, we'd bring our nuclear bombs home and we wouldn't need to leave them over there anymore. But we have this alliance, NATO and Europe. And so we continue to leave our nuclear bombs in six different nations in Europe. And it really does get worse than this. Quoting again from Time magazine, under a NATO agreement struck during the Cold War, the bombs, which are technically owned by the U.S., can be transferred to the control of a host nation's air force in times of conflict, the 2009 Time article stated.
So in times of conflict, they can take them over, they train with them. And now it's getting even worse. You know, even as Europe openly talks again and again about breaking with America, the U.S. is selling them these advanced fighters and then paying for these bombs to be upgraded to fit on these stealth aircraft carrier-capable fighters. And they're setting up the production line, even as we speak, to upgrade these nuclear bombs. You know, Italy, like I said, they're going to buy these fighters, they have these bombs, they have an aircraft carrier that can carry these fighters that they've upgraded to carry F-35s. So soon Italy is going to be able to launch a stealth nuclear attack just about anywhere in the world from an aircraft carrier. And all of that capability comes thanks to the U.S. You know, they wouldn't have these bombs without the U.S. They wouldn't have stealth without the U.S. That's an American invention given to them. That's just, you know, just mind-boggling. I mean, how on earth could you have forecast something like this? That's just really unique and unprecedented for one nation to give so much to another. Who could have possibly forecast that? Well, the Bible did, and in that show, Mr. Flurry explained that prophecy. His what he said. This is clip 8.
Let me read you a few scriptures that make it even more disturbing, I believe. But it's all going to end well. Let me say that at this point. It's all going to end in a beautiful way that mankind could not even imagine. Ezekiel 16 and verse 28. You have played the whore also with the Assyrians. It's talking to Israel. Who is Israel? Well, our book on the United States and Britain in Prophecy has been teaching people that for years. And if you don't have a copy, please do request it and read it and study it. It's an amazing book. And without it, without that understanding, you can't understand one-third of your Bible, which is prophecy. Verse 28, though, of this chapter 16, you have played the whore with the Assyrians because you were unsatiable. Yea, you have played the harlot with them and yet could not be satisfied. So the nations of Israel, three of them, played the harlot in the end time. And it has a lover here it talks about a little later. And it's Israel, again, our lovers would be Israel's closest ally, wouldn't it? What is this talking about? Who is Israel? Who is Assyria? We must know. You and I have to know that. If we're going to understand Bible prophecy, we must know it, and we don't have much time to learn it. Verse 34, and the contrary is in you from other women, well, different than other prostitutes or whores, in your whoredoms, whereas none follows you to commit whoredoms, and in that you give a reward, and no reward is given unto you, therefore you are contrary. This is a different prostitute than any other. We go around, well, you think maybe God might be talking about something like giving nuclear bombs to our lovers? Better think about that. We better think about it because these are some really serious and dreadful prophecies. This book is about end time Israel.
So they go around giving gifts, like the Bible said. Well, the Bible says, well, you have these lovers and you go and you give gifts to them. And what do we see Britain and America doing? Well, giving nuclear bombs, giving them stealth technology, these new advanced aeroplanes so they can deliver these nuclear bombs secretly anywhere in the world. In my trumpet brief, I quoted from an article by Mr. Gerald Flory back in 1999. It's just a really powerful article warning about the dangers based on just some history of doing this. And it talks about the danger of a surprise attack. I mean, these nuclear bombs on stealth aircraft, that's a pretty big risk of a surprise attack. That's a huge level of trust to be handing those out. You're making, you know, if you make a mistake there, well, that article was called, I think, Alagamorga. I don't even know how to pronounce that name, but a mistake you only make once. And certainly that's the case when you're talking about giving nuclear bombs and stealth aircraft to another country. History warns us against this. The Bible prophesied that this would happen. And God says in so many places where your lovers are going to turn against you. He says that they're going to use these gifts against you. They'll turn against you. But he says it's all for a purpose. In Ezekiel 23, he talks about this prophecy, and it ends in verse 49 with God saying, well, then you shall know that I am the Lord God. It's going to end with Britain and America knowing God. So that's a glorious ending. Well, that is about all I've got time for. I'd really like to urge you, though, to keep your eye on, to watch that Key of David that comes out on Friday, because as you saw, it just ties in so directly with so many of these events that is happening right now in Europe. So keep watching for that. We'll have that up on thetrumpet.com. That will be available on YouTube. It's called something like, it's part three of the series that we've been watching over the past couple of weeks.